Audio recording now. Again, for those of you who have just joined us, welcome to today's Research to Practice webinar hosted by the SPRC Training Institute. At this moment, about 500 people are connected to the webinar. I'm delighted to report that over 1,200 people registered to attend this webinar from across the country, and I'd like to welcome you all. Now, on to our presentations. Today, we are fortunate enough to have Dr. Scott Poland with us. His presentation is titled Postvention in Schools, Responding Effectively After a Suicide. Scott Poland is Associate Professor and Co-Director of the Suicide and Violence Prevention Office at Nova Southeastern University in Florida. He's an internationally recognized expert on school crisis, youth violence, suicide intervention, self-injury, school safety, threat assessment, parenting, and the delivery of psychological services in schools. He's currently the co-director of a three-year federal grant for suicide prevention at Nova Southeastern University. He's lectured and written extensively on these subjects, including 4 books and numerous best practices chapters, and his writings have been translated into several languages. Dr. Poland served on the President's Roundtable on Youth Violence, and he's testified about the needs of children before the U.S. Congress on 4 occasions. He is a founding member of the National Emergency Assistance Team for the National Association of School Psychologists, and he currently serves as the Prevention Director for the American Association of Suicidology. Dr. Poland has led multiple national crisis teams responding to violent incidents in schools and has assisted schools and communities after terrorism acts and natural disasters. He has also been an expert witness in numerous legal cases. At this point, Tiffany is going to unmute Dr. Poland's phone line, and we will be able to hear him continuing with the presentation.
Thank you very much, Gail. It's indeed my pleasure to be here with my esteemed colleagues, and I compliment SPRC and AFSP for the toolkit. I think it is much needed by schools. And I've long admired the suicide prevention efforts taking place in LAUSD. Having worked in the schools for 26 years, I'm very familiar with the way schools struggle and the aftermath of a suicide. In fact, few things are more devastating or more uncertain in terms of how to proceed. And basically, schools have really not known what to do. Some of the information before about concerns about dramatizing and glamorizing deaths has caused schools really to do nothing, when in reality it's an opportunity where there can certainly be prevention and important information, as well as helping everybody concerned to deal with the shock and the confusion and the grief that often is experienced. And I want to talk a little bit today about some examples, some of which have gone well, some of which haven't gone so well, and trying to figure out exactly what is the best thing for schools to do. And if we look at why postvention in schools, if we would move to that particular slide, it's to give schools guidance, to be able to reach out, to be able to help the students with the shock and the confusion, and very importantly, to try to figure out, do they know where to go for help and how to help each other? And at least one occasion in a middle school classroom in Houston, I asked 30 students, all devastated by the death of yet another person to suicide, I asked, how many of you know there's a 24-hour crisis hotline you can call every moment of the day to get help for yourself or someone else? And only one student out of 30 raised her hand. That happened to be my own daughter. And it's just so important that students know 1-800-SUICIDE so that they can get connected with a trained adult. So schools are often very unsure. There are certain practices that schools might engage in that are not best practices and that will not result in the help that young people need. And it's just critical that schools are able to respond and know what to do with a team response. And I very much believe the wisest decisions in education are made by a team of people. And the wise principal would get psychologists and counselors together and decide on a plan of action. And of course, today, because of the communication and cell phones and internet access, schools sometimes think, well, we've got some time to figure this out. In reality, word travels very quickly, and it's really critical that schools make plans, verify the death, know whether or not it was a suicide, and then basically tell the truth. And I want to give a couple of examples, and one of those has to do with a principal that perhaps could have done things better. And he was one of those guys that didn't call for any help after the suicide, but as soon as I heard, I went immediately to his office. And as I walked in, he said, "I just made the announcement." And I said, "Well, what announcement did you make to all the students at middle school?" And he said, "Well, I announced for anybody who wanted more information about the student's death to come down to the cafeteria right now." And of course, I was immediately trying to convince him, yes, to tell him the truth, but to do it in classrooms, not 1,300 students in a cafeteria. But he insisted. And when he told them that the death was by suicide, the student reactions ranged from disbelief to anger to some hyperventilated. They turned over some tables. They immediately decided it was the girlfriend's fault and they were going to get her. We actually had to call for security, and she was escorted out of the school, never to return. And it took us hours to get control of the school. So I am a big believer in telling students the truth, doing it in a classroom, and basically guiding everyone to focus on the living and what can we all do to help each other and what can we all do to prevent further suicide. So an effective and a well-planned response is absolutely critical for schools. Now, I mentioned earlier about the importance of assisting the survivors, identifying those that might be most at risk right now, planning with along with the family, appropriate memorialization, planning that with the family and with the fellow students. Sometimes I get a call like this: "Well, we think the students are planning to do this and that, and we're not sure it's appropriate." And I always suggest, well, let's get with the key students that are involved. Let's hear them out, and let's see if we can guide them towards some appropriate memorials. And, of course, my favorites have to do with those that actually focus on the living. And a very scary thing for schools today is contagion and suicide clusters. And I've actually gone to now 8 different communities that have sadly experienced those clusters. And there's a lot that we don't know, but there's still a lot that we have learned about the importance of a response that involves the entire community. It's been said that no single entity or agency can stop a suicide cluster or contagion situation. And unfortunately, it appears that adolescents are the most susceptible to imitate suicidal behavior. So it's critical that we talk about that today and get some ideas about what are the best ways to respond to a contagion or a cluster situation. My feelings are that we have a lot of clusters that have occurred among schools and communities in the United States, but we haven't really wanted to acknowledge them. If we do, then somebody is going to be looking at the school and the community and asking, what's wrong? What are we not doing that's important in terms of taking care of our youth? Students often really struggle with what is the best thing to do in the way of a memorial for our deceased classmate, our deceased loved ones, especially difficult for families. And as I said earlier, I really recommend living memorials, things that are done that focus on the needs of the living in memory of the deceased. And one of the things that schools struggle with is that students will perhaps arrive the very next day with T-shirts with the picture of the deceased, and schools are going to try to decide, is that disruptive? Is that going to, you know, impact learning today? Is that something that should be allowed? Do we allow it today? Do we not allow it after today? And, of course, the toolkit provides much-needed guidance in so many of these areas. And then the media. The media has often been criticized as contributing to the contagion effect of youth suicide. And I want to share with you a media headline than one of them that was possibly the worst that I have ever seen. But the headline was about the popular student who fell to dark and lonely thoughts. And of course, it was on the front page of the newspaper. It had a picture of a beautiful girl. It described how she got her best dress cleaned at the cleaners. It was black, of course. She put it on, drove to the Holodome, ordered a Coke, put a cyanide tablet in the Coke, and fell dead to the floor. The last sentence in the article was, she was just too sensitive for this tough world of ours. And that one example is pretty much everything not to do with regard to media coverage. And, you know, the media and suicide goes all the way back several hundred years to the book The Sorrows of Young Werther. In fact, that book, which described the suicide of a middle school age student, actually got banned in a number of different countries. And so today we actually know the media influence by the term the Werther effect. So critical issues for schools and communities, and of course there are wonderful guidelines out there for the media helping them to focus on prevention, to avoid the details of the method, to avoid a picture of a handsome young man or a beautiful girl, and to avoid indicating the suicide was a result of something simplistic or romantic. Now, in the classroom, students have a way of getting to the absolute concrete nitty-gritty of this. They almost always ask me, how did she do it? And I just believe the simplest thing to do is tell the truth. It was a gunshot. It was hanging. We're not going to dwell on the explicit details. And I'm here to help you. How do we help you with some of the things that are on your mind? How do we make sure everybody gets the help they need? How do we prevent further suicides? Second question is often, why did he or she do it? And I think the simplest thing for us to do is to answer with the statement, we're never going to know exactly why. The answers abide with the victim. We could talk about general factors in youth suicide, but really the focus, again, has to be on helping you. You lost a classmate. You lost a friend. The third thing that they often ask of me is, why didn't God stop her? You know, I don't claim to be a religious expert. In fact, I have a son who's the minister, not me. But I can share with you something that I've heard a number of representatives of the clergy say that works for me. I've heard them say things like, well, God wishes that she could have been stopped. God sounded the alarm, but God could not stop her. She's embraced by God, but God is actually saddened that she didn't stay on this earth and do God's work over her natural lifetime. That really works for me because it's not indicating that someone was chosen at age 14 to die by suicide, yet they're embraced in terms of whatever afterlife someone might believe in. And at a funeral I went to not too long ago for yet another student suicide victim, I'm really sorry to tell you that there were large numbers of students there, about 1,000. And of course, we hope those funerals can be after school or on Saturdays so that the young people's parents can attend with them. So this large congregation of students heard the representative of the clergy say, her burdens were too great. Because her burdens were so great, she had to come to God. And I wanted to scream as a psychologist, tell them through worship, tell them through Bible study, don't just leave it. She had to come to God. So this is where the partnership is so important in terms of everyone working together and school officials and mental health actually working with clergy so that there can be a preventative message. And at least one school district in the Midwest, because I was involved in the case, was sued over failure to implement best practices postvention procedures. Basically, the school, after the death of the younger brother, did nothing. No outreach to siblings, no outreach to family, no outreach to friends, pretty much took the viewpoint, well, the death occurred away from school. What's that have to do with us? They were actually quoted as saying, we don't do mental health. We have no one with suicide prevention knowledge or responsibilities. Well, the older brother died by suicide 6 months later, and the mom actually brought a lawsuit against the school district. It settled out of court through mediation. I do know what she wanted. She told me specifically she wanted best practices suicide postvention procedures, which you're going to hear all about from Joanne. That's what she wanted. She wanted best practices, prevention, intervention, and postvention. She didn't want their money, but they refused to work on those things. Instead, they fought her in court and spent a large amount of money fighting the case. And it's the only legal matter I'm aware of that actually raises the question of postvention, but I think that schools are making strides and being more systematic and implementing best practices procedures. Oh, and I thought of one more thing. A student asked me in a small town in Texas, one day too late, he said, "Why weren't you here last week? If you'd have been here last week, I think I would have known my friend Keith was suicidal. I would have known what to do." And of course, whenever I recount that example, it always makes me think, why aren't we there today in every middle school and high school in America teaching kids how to help themselves, where to go for help, don't keep a secret? Oh, I know that we can't prevent every youth suicide, but we can certainly prevent the majority with much more awareness. And I'm a big fan of depression screening. I'm a big fan of getting the information to the kids themselves. And this next slide comes really out of some recommendations from the Center for Disease Control in terms of who might potentially be our next victim. Did somebody back out of a suicide pact, which is rare? Did somebody have a last negative interaction? I could give you examples where they said things to her like, "Do it tonight. Here's where to put the gun, pull the trigger. It'll be quick, it won't hurt." Then you've got those that now realize, "I missed the goodbye messages she was trying to tell me." You know, and the suicide of a young person in a school and community is actually like throwing a rock into a pond, the ripple effect of the schools, the neighborhood, or the churches. And a counselor will say, "Well, you know, after this suicide that occurred yesterday, there are 10 kids in the eighth grade that I've already talked to about their suicidal thoughts and plans. Do I need to see them today?" And the answer to that is, of course, pretty simple, because, yes, it's now more on their mind because somebody actually did this. Barriers and inhibitions are down. This next slide is something that Rich Lieberman and I know well, some training from Israeli psychologists. And of course, this slide is applicable to any crisis or tragic situation. But the question is really pretty straightforward in terms of who might have been in geographic proximity, whether it was a car accident, whether they found the suicide victim, whether the popular coach had the heart attack in front of them, who was in close geographic proximity? Second question, who was close in terms of psychosocial proximity? And the absolute closest would be if somebody had a twin brother or a twin sister, or maybe they had a sibling 1 year younger or 1 year older. And of course, every victim had best friends, and then they had friends and acquaintances. So who was close in terms of relationships with the victim? And the third circle has to do with population at risk. Every kid has their own unique history with regards to crisis, tragedy, and loss. And I actually find that schools often have a short memory. And in one occasion, the young man had actually found his sister hanging to death. And let's pick it up 5 weeks later. He's failing every subject. And one at a time, all the teachers say, "He's so smart, I can't understand. Oh, well, they're all going to leave the conference." I'm the one person saying, "Wait a minute. Don't you remember he found his sister dead, a suicide victim, 5 weeks ago? Can't we do something besides fail him in every class?" Regression academically is to be expected. So whenever I do a consultation about a school crisis, and 2 weeks ago I was in Brazil responding to a horrific school shooting, and recently I responded to a suicide cluster in Wisconsin, I'm always going to ask, what else is there? Before you called about what happened today or yesterday, tell me what other things was the school and the community still having difficulty with. So, and of course, this is sort of a psychological triage, which basically means who would we believe would be at most at risk for reckless behavior, substance abuse, depression, and even thoughts of suicide, those that were close in geographic proximity, those that had their own trauma history, those that had a very close relationship with the victim. And moving on, you're going to hear a lot today about the importance of getting all the stakeholders involved in the aftermath of suicide. I will share a frustration in that all the communities I've gone to, the group that has been the most reluctant to come to the planning table has been the physicians in the community. And basically, we have a national recommendation that all teenagers need to be screened for thoughts of depression and thoughts of suicide every time they see the family doctor. And it's not unusual for the teenager who died by suicide to have seen the family doctor shortly before they died. So I've been very pleased with law enforcement, mental health, clergy, school, community officials, but I think we need to work harder to get the medical community around the table to work on preventing suicide clusters. Now, a couple of key points, because I know that I will need to finish my comments in just a few moments, but it's always so important to make sure that everybody knows not to keep a secret, take it seriously. In my work here at the university, we have put on over 200 training sessions, and it's not unusual for us to put a slide up about somebody's life that's just gone terribly downhill. They're going to give up, their partner left, they're failing out of school, they don't know what to do, they're planning to give up. And well-educated people say, I'd give them a little pep talk. I'd tell them it isn't that bad. And in reality, what we need everybody to do is recognize the seriousness, be a good listener, let them know that there is help available. You're not the first person to feel this way. There are trained individuals who can help you. And then again, of course, we need the community partnership. Parents must be involved. And I've learned something over the years, and that is I stopped titling a presentation for parents, Suicide Prevention is Everyone's Responsibility. Today, I title it Safeguarding Our Children and Promoting Success and Resiliency. And I went from having a handful of parents to hundreds of parents. And of course, they still get that important information about suicide prevention. But we've got to reach parents through meetings, through newsletters, through articles, and let them know that youth suicide does happen, it can happen, and we need to all work together to prevent it. I mentioned earlier, I'm a big fan of depression screening, and I think it's important that all school personnel know that SOS and Teen Screen are listed on the best practices residency register. And the key thing, of course, is how do we get schools to actually investigate and to seriously look at depression screening and to form a task force. What I've actually found is that resistance to depression screening is usually dramatically reduced after multiple suicides. But since we know they work, why do we have to wait for the first suicide death or even a second or a third suicide death? And of course, I'll close my comments with the journey through postvention begins and ends with an emphasis on prevention and obviously on preparation, which you'll hear more about from my esteemed colleagues. Thank you.
Dr. Pullen, thank you so much for giving us that overview of postvention and why it's important in the school setting and for illustrating that with a number of examples from your experience in the field. At this point, we have time for a couple of questions. There was one that came in. It was a clarifying question. Someone who asked what you changed the name of your program to and how it attracted more parents.
All right. In getting parents there, we need incentives. And I'll just compliment the Wisconsin High School recently. They had extra credit for students if their parents were there. They served ice cream. They had babysitting. They actually gave away a prize, a drawing at the end, and we titled the presentation, safeguarding your children and building success and resiliency. And they heard information about, sadly, the leading causes of death for kids in America are accidents, homicide, and suicide. How do you keep them safe? They heard information about good parenting. It's not enough to know your kids' friends. You've got to know your kids' friends' parents. They heard information about being involved in their kids' lives. And it wasn't all doom and gloom. I mean, some examples actually had them chuckling, and just really important to have the parents of adolescents involved in their kids' lives. And that would save so many tragedies in our country.
Okay, there were a couple of people who wrote in, and they were curious about the names of the two best practice suicide screening programs that you mentioned, Signs of Suicide and Columbia Teen Screen, and where they could find information on those screenings. And I'd like to direct people to the Best Practices Registry that Dr. Poland mentioned. It's a collaborative effort between the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP, and SPRC. And you can find a link to the Best Practices Registry on our website, which is www.sprc.org, and that's where you can find more information not only on those two programs in particular, but on a range of programs considered to adhere to best practices in the field that are specifically designed for school settings. Okay, I think that is about it for questions right now. I know that a number of people have written in as well, and we'll be holding your questions to the end so that we can continue on with our presentations. So thank you again, Dr. Poland. And at this point, I would like to introduce our next presenter, Joanne Harpel, who is the Senior Director for Public Affairs and Postvention with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP. She is a survivor of her brother's suicide and joined AFSP in 2002 as its first ever Director of Survivor Initiatives. Ms. Harpel is responsible for the full spectrum of AFSP's initiatives relating to the aftermath of suicide, including International Survivors of Suicide Day, the Support Group Facilitator Training Program, and the Survivor Outreach Program. A frequent media spokesperson and lecturer throughout the country, she also oversees AFSP's public affairs efforts, including constituency relations, media relations, communications, and social media. So at this point, I would like to ask Tiffany to unmute Joanne's line.
Good afternoon. What I'd like to do is start with an overview of the toolkit. The toolkit is a brand new resource. It was developed jointly by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and the Suicide Prevention Resource Center. And I want to be sure to acknowledge my co-editor, Peggy West, of the Suicide Prevention Resource Center. We chaired a committee that was comprised of a small working group and then a much larger group of experts to work together over the course of several years to develop a resource that could be used by schools in the aftermath of a suicide or really any other death. Much of the guidance that's contained in the toolkit would be applicable if a student died from some cause other than suicide, but we wanted to make sure that schools were clear that the guidance would be applicable to a suicide because we know there are a lot of special concerns that come up for them in the aftermath of a suicide. The resource is available free of charge online at the websites of both the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, and the URLs are right there on your screen. And it's intended to be publicly available and disseminated very widely. We wanted to be sure that schools could use this in a very practical way when they're facing a real-time crisis. So this is not meant to be a training program or a comprehensive curriculum. It's really meant to be something that the schools can download and use in real time as they're trying to manage the crisis. It was developed in collaboration with a couple of dozen key experts in a wide variety of disciplines. So we worked with people who were experts in crisis response and clinicians and school personnel and researchers. We tried wherever possible to base the content of the toolkit on research where it was available. Sadly, there's not much out there. With the exception of the issue of contagion, there's really not much research out there that we found really bore on the subject. So in many cases, we were really relying on expert consensus from this interdisciplinary group of experts. The toolkit has several key messages that underlie most of the content of the guidance that we give. And the first key message is that schools should strive wherever possible to treat all deaths in the same way. So having one approach that they use if a student were to die of cancer or in a car accident, and a different approach for a student who's died of suicide, we felt really reinforced the stigma that still surrounds suicide and was deeply painful to the family and the close friends. So the first point that we ask schools to keep in mind as a goal is to treat all deaths comparably. But then again, at the same time, we recognize, of course, that adolescents and teens can be vulnerable to the risk of contagion. So we also advise schools that it's very important that they not inadvertently either simplify or glamorize either the student or the death. So how do you reconcile those two messages, that you treat all deaths the same way and also that you need to be mindful of the risk of contagion? The way that we recommend that they reconcile those two is to emphasize that someone who dies by suicide was very likely struggling with a serious mental health issue. Most commonly, that would be depression or anxiety, and that often those illnesses, although they may be experienced by the person, may not be apparent to the outside world, may not have been apparent to others in the school or to their friends. It may have shown up as behavior problems or substance abuse, or may not have been apparent at all. And then the fourth key message is a reinforcement that help is available for the students who are left behind and who may be struggling with their own emotional reactions and their grief, or who may be at risk themselves for suicide. And so that we want to make sure that schools keep a focus on making sure that they disseminate information about local resources, including mental health clinics and other services that may be available, crisis lines, and so on. So the entire toolkit has really the two goals of postvention that Dr. Poland referred to. First is, of course, to reduce the risk of contagion. That's something that's very frightening and that we're all mindful of. And second of all, to reduce the emotional distress of the survivors in the community left behind after a suicide. The toolkit itself is broken into several main sections, and I just want to touch briefly on some of the points that we focus on in each of those sections, just so that you have a flavor for the kind of information that it contains. So the first section has to do with crisis response. We assumed when we were drafting the toolkit that schools would have a basic crisis plan in place. So the toolkit doesn't go through the nuts and bolts of creating a crisis plan. It starts from the assumption that a crisis plan exists and then gives school guidance about how to implement the crisis plan with respect to a suicide and some considerations that may be particular to that case. So the first is an admonition to schools that they make sure that they get the facts before they start taking any action, that it's particularly important in terms of suicide because of the way the rumor mill can ramp up so quickly and can really exacerbate the situation, that the school confirm with either the coroner or the medical examiner first that, in fact, this death has been ruled a suicide. And we give some guidance to the schools about what to do if the death has not yet been confirmed a suicide, or if it's been confirmed officially but the family doesn't want that information disclosed. The second area that we discuss within crisis response is working with the media. That it can often happen that when there's a suicide in a community, the media focuses in very quickly and can really exacerbate an already volatile situation. And so we include a link to the media recommendations that many of you may be very familiar with, which are available also on the websites of both AFSP and SPRC. But those are consensus recommendations for use by the media when reporting on suicide. And we also recommend that the school designate one person to be a media spokesperson, and we include some guidance for that person so that they're respectful of the role of the media, but that they try to work with the media in a way that maintains safety for the students. The third point we make is to encourage the school to have some kind of forum to communicate with the parents and other interested community members, to disseminate information and answer questions without creating a situation that spins out of control. So we really caution against having large open mic free-for-all kinds of sessions and instead recommend that they combine a presentation that the school personnel would be making to the parents in a large group and then breaking out into small groups for more of a question and answer. And we provide several templates and handouts for how the schools can do that most effectively and how they can communicate about mental illness and suicide in adolescents and teens, information about how to talk to adolescents and teens about suicide. So we really give them some very concrete tools that they can use as they try to communicate effectively with the parents and encourage the parents to then in turn communicate effectively with their children. And then the fourth element of crisis response, of course, is to identify and screen other students who may now be at potential risk, because of course the risk of contagion is always a concern, and as Dr. Poland touched on, we always want to be mindful of the safety of the kids who are left behind. But of course the risk of suicide in the surviving students, as important as it is not the only concern. A parallel concern is helping the students cope what's referred to often as emotional regulation. And what that really means is giving the students a forum and an outlet to manage what is very likely to be very strong emotional reactions, but also trying to work with the school to enable them to regain the equilibrium and return to the primary purpose that they're established for, of course, which is education. So we encourage things like meeting with students in small groups, not making announcements over the loudspeaker, not having large assemblies, not taking steps that will fuel the emotional volatility, but rather taking steps to manage the emotional reactions of the students, recognizing that they're normal and giving them an appropriate forum to channel them and cope with them. We also, in the toolkit, reflect the point that Dr. Poland made a few minutes ago, in that the school is not in a position of having to cope with the aftermath of suicide alone. It can be very easy for a school to become a lightning rod for blame and a focus of anger, and we really try to remind schools to be mindful that they exist as part of a larger community and that they, to the maximum extent possible, should really work cooperatively with the other individuals and entities in the community who also have a vested interest in managing the situation well and who have expertise to bear that can be very helpful. So, for example, we encourage schools to be in communication with the family and with the funeral director in terms of the preparations and the logistics for the funeral, because the school may be in possession of really important information about how many people to expect at the funeral, whether there may be a need for counselors to attend the funeral, whether there may be a need possibly for additional security. The school, although it's not strictly speaking in charge of anything having to do with the funeral, having open communication can be extremely helpful. Likewise, we encourage the schools to be in communication with the local police department if it turns out that the kids are gathering off campus and having vigils and or meeting places and drinking, that again, it may not literally speaking be within the school's authority, but the school may know about things that are going on, and being in communication with the local authorities can really help keep the kids safe. Perhaps the most frequently asked question that we received in connection with drafting the toolkit was what to do about this issue of memorialization. Schools really struggle for a whole variety of reasons with what to do about graduation, what to do about the yearbook, what kind of memorials they should have. Is it safe to plant a tree? Is it safe to put up a plaque? What kinds of options are there that are available? It was a large impetus behind the toolkit. And we really encourage schools to attempt to strike a balance, because there is a basic human desire to remember those we've lost, and it can be very challenging for schools to try to balance the students' grief and the family's desire to have their child memorialized with at the same time the schools need to continue to be able to educate the students and to avoid contagion. And so it's not always a linear path to try to decide what makes the most sense. So again, you go back to the key considerations, to strive to treat all deaths the same way to the extent possible, because doing nothing reinforces stigma. You don't want to be insensitive, and also at the same time being aware not to glamorize or romanticize the student in a way that you fear might risk contagion. So the toolkit offers some very specific creative suggestions about the kinds of activities that may be undertaken by way of memorialization that meet those various and competing needs, a lot of emphasis on things like community service, participation in awareness events, raising money for local community mental health centers, to purchase books, for example, on mental health for the local library. Again, the idea of these living memorials, motivating the surviving kids and the community to take some step in memory of the person who's lost, but with an eye toward moving forward in a way that's safe and effective. The toolkit also has a section on social media, which of course didn't exist in materials that were created 5 or certainly 10 years ago on the subject. And we realize that as with the funeral, social media is largely outside of the school's literal control. But at the same time, there are ways in which it can still be utilized by the school as part of their response. And one of the things that we really encourage schools to do is to identify some key students. Maybe they were close friends with the student who died. Maybe they're the ones who are most savvy about social media. But to work in partnership with some key students who are going to, A, be most closely in tune with what's happening online and at these various sites, and also to create a sense of buy-in that the school is working together with the students and not rather than at cross purposes. And the idea is to identify and monitor the social networking sites that are most relevant to this student population, to use those sites as forums to share prevention-oriented safe messaging about suicide and about mental illness, to monitor those sites because you may see posts or messages that are worrisome. They may be from kids who are having difficulty with the intensity of their own grief and need support and help and resources. There may also be messages that are posted that indicate that the student may now be suicidal themselves and may be at risk, and so it provides an opportunity to reach out to them and intervene, and the toolkit has some very specific advice about what to do if faced with those kinds of messages to intervene in a safe way. So just once again, the toolkit is available free of charge on the websites of both the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, and we encourage you to take a look at it before the crisis strikes so you have a sense of what's available, but also know that it is designed very intentionally to be used in the heat of the moment and to be as simple and straightforward and easy to implement as possible. So thank you.
Joanne, thank you very much for providing an overview of the toolkit. I know that we were really excited that was finally available to the public and that we were able to provide this innovative online toolkit free of charge that had very practical guidance for schools when they were experiencing a crisis. And obviously something that would provide recommendations before a crisis actually even occurred. So there were a number of questions that came in during your presentation. I think some of those we're going to save until the end, but one in particular that a couple of people posed was whether or not this toolkit was something that could be useful for college campuses.
The answer is yes. Most of the guidance in the toolkit is broad enough and general enough that it would be applicable to colleges, although we have also already been asked to do a new version of it that would be specific to colleges and that would address some of the issues relating to a student population that was over the age of majority and living on campus, which are two factors that, for the most part, are not applicable to most high schools. So I would say, for the time being, yes, it could absolutely be used for colleges, but stay tuned because it is likely that over the next couple of years there will be an additional resource available specifically for that population.
Great. Thank you very much. And like I said, there were a number of questions and comments that came in. We're going to save those until the end so that we can move on to Richard Lieberman's presentation. But again, thank you so much, Joanne. So at this point, I'm going to introduce Rich Lieberman, who has coordinated suicide prevention services for Los Angeles Unified School District for the past 25 years. He's also a lecturer in the Graduate School of Education at Loyola Marymount University. Mr. Lieberman is co-author of School Crisis Prevention and Intervention, The Prepare Model, and numerous book chapters and articles on youth suicide prevention, crisis intervention, and responding to self-injurious students in the schools. He has co-written and appeared in numerous violence and suicide prevention videos, including an HBO documentary, and serves on national crisis teams sent on behalf of the U.S. Department of Education, to assist many communities in the aftermath of youth suicide clusters and school violence. He's going to be talking to us today about more of the practical application of some of the practices that Joanne was just talking about, and we'll draw from his many years of experience to inform that content and share some examples with us. So, Rich, I believe that you've been unmuted at this point.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
We can.
That's great.
The floor is yours.
Well, I want to thank SPRC for the opportunity and the privilege to present today with Scott and Joanne. I thought their presentations were excellent. They covered every point. So let's go straight to the questions. Nope, just joking. I also want to thank my team here in school mental health who have supported suicide prevention services for 25 years now. We have one of the longest running suicide prevention efforts in place in schools in America today. And the stakes are high here in Los Angeles because we have over 700,000 students in Los Angeles Unified School District. Not too many folks want to talk to us about caseload. Sadly, just days after the toolkit was released, I had to use it in the aftermath of a 14-year-old Latina middle school student who died by suicide after school at home. The school was devastated, needless to say. What's unique is that in this case, as in many cases, the responders were also survivors. The case points out that many of these kids that die by suicide today are not mysteries to school crisis teams and to school mental health professionals. And they often have documented efforts to intervene with students over a long period of time. So it's, you can imagine, it's a very difficult time to think, much less respond. So Joanne's message of it's best to do these things in prevention and preparedness, then on the morning of the crisis itself. LAUSD has mandates in place. Both Scott and I recommend all the time that you write these policies and procedures down. And LAUSD for many years has had mandates for both school site crisis teams and local district crisis teams to support school site crisis teams when they are overwhelmed in the aftermath of a tragedy. It is we can't underestimate the value of the school site team, which is the foundation for our suicide prevention program. The components of our program are undertaken by these school site teams. There are three components. We have a prevention component, which involves extensive gatekeeper training for crisis teams, for students, for parents, and for staff. And I think what's important is that there are very different messages that we take to each of those groups. We have an intervention component which spells out a simple four-step approach. And if you're going to implement a program, I always say let's keep it as simple as possible. So four steps to follow, which includes documentation. Also, just a word here for being culturally responsive in your crisis intervention. An example of that would be we have materials in many native languages for our diverse population, and most important, to have parent brochures. Ours are in five different languages. For more about all the research and best practices in school crisis prevention and intervention, check out the PREPARE curriculum from the National Association of School Psychologists. A lot of this looked, a lot of the textbook looked at the literature and the research, all of which is evolving as we speak, to determine, you know, what we did back in the 80s and 90s, was there really an evidence base for it? We found that much of the recommendations did turn out to be best practices. Next couple of slides address some special postvention issues. Of course, stigma and contagion have been mentioned already. I do want to say that certainly in the aftermath of a suicide on a campus, everyone is uncomfortable. People withdraw from one another. They're very reluctant to talk.
there is much stigma, not only around possessing mental illness such as depression, but in seeking help for it. And we have many diverse cultures that when parents are called by school personnel and advised that their child might be depressed and could benefit from counseling, they are more likely to take their children, and I believe they do this in the best interests of their children. But I think they're more prone to take their child to the doctor or the church or the mall before they will take their children for mental health services. Moving on, Scott has talked already about contagion, and it is addressed in the toolkit. Once again, I do want to say how happy I am with the toolkit and everything, Joanne, that you mentioned in terms about you want it, you know, it to be a live, active kind of document that's unfolding just as the crisis is unfolding, and that's what proved to be true. We had everything we really needed at our fingertips. I do want to emphasize, you know, and reinforce the point that Scott made earlier in terms of stressing honesty and being honest and limiting the details of the suicide. And yet still being honest, many of us are watching a story unfold in our headlines today, a very high-profile suicide in the music industry. And yet, when I read the article, the Associated Press had described in details how this man went about asphyxiating himself. So there is a plethora of materials available from AFSP and AAS and SPRC, did I get all the initials there, that focus on working with the media. And new from SPRC also is a handout for working with the clergy, which are all quite excellent. I do want to point out that when you have a crisis in the schools, rarely is it limited to one school. In the case of our recent suicide, we had a younger sister in an elementary school and an older sister in the high school, both schools incredibly impacted as well. So school personnel have to collaborate with neighboring schools where siblings attend. We sadly are seeing in some of the literature around some groups of children and populations of children where we're seeing an increase in kids attempting suicide in proximity of others. So it's very important to reach out to surviving siblings and their schools. The social networking sites, I feared, as probably Joanne did, that when the toolkit came out, the section on social networking would have already been obsolete because this field is expanding as we speak. Certainly in our case, our middle school student went home and chatted on MySpace for a while. Many kids knew as a result of it. She blamed others that were turned out also to be students within the middle school. She also talked about entering into a pact with another student. All of these students were identified because we were lurking on those accounts to the best ability that we can. I'm coining the phrase, kids are in virtual crisis rooms now where they can feel free to share messages. And the point very well taken is we need to involve more students in our crisis response, utilizing these students to monitor these pages so that we can identify kids in need. Some practical suggestions. One of the key findings we found in looking at the literature for the PREPARE model was that if we intervene when it's not indicated, we could do harm. So all the cautions that you're hearing today about avoiding universal interventions and loudspeaker and assembly kinds of notifications, we certainly hope that you're hearing that. And recently, when a principal called the hotline here in LA in the aftermath of the death of a parent by suicide. The first question that he asks is, please tell me I don't have to go into every one of my classrooms and talk about suicide. And at least I could assuage his feelings there. We were not going to go into every classroom unless it was indicated. So especially in elementary schools. As we see that staff is going to be critical in playing a role in triage, but staff also has to be triaged, just a word that all of these kinds of tragic losses have tremendous impact on staff, and we want to triage our staff as well so that when we're notifying staff of a student that has died by suicide, we're doing it sensitively, we're doing it in person. And we're reaching out to them. So I would also, a practical suggestion would be to have a fund of substitutes at the school on the morning of the first intervention so teachers can be relieved of their duties during the course of the day if they have to come down and seek some assistance from crisis team members. The next two slides address a suicide prevention checklist for crisis teams when it's very difficult to think on the first morning of a crisis. I'd like to thank Stephen Brock from Sacramento State for some of these suggestions here. And due to the time constraints today, I won't be going through every one of these points, but I will address just a few of them in the beginning. I think, you know, number one is verify your information, gather your information, and make sure you have reliable information from multiple sources before you put out any kind of fact sheets letters to parents as well, because Scott and I both have seen postventions gone bad when bad information has been released way too early. I almost kind of like the situation where we don't know, so that we can put a letter out right away that says we do not know if this was accidental or intentional. However, one of the points that I wanted to make, I think I'm going to go backwards to a slide here, has to do with the fifth item on the list, which is reaching out to the parents and the family of the suicide victim. Administration will frequently ask, you know, in addition to expressing sympathy and offering my support, what else do I need to cover with the family? And of course, a couple of other points here to take a look at. One is that they will play a big role in triage, in being able to identify some of their child's friends who may be in need of assistance. This is always helpful for the school, because sometimes a student has friends that do not attend the same school, especially if they belong to clubs. And the club could be a countywide club, so the impact could be spread throughout the county as well. We also want to discuss with the family and ask their support in terms of the postmention response, and work with them in terms of identifying details about the death that can be shared. This is very critical in terms of some of the materials that have been provided by the toolkit. I know schools really struggle when parents do not want information released, so there's a letter that addresses that. Sometimes they are cooperative. In the case of my middle school death, the parent was very cooperative with the school's efforts to deal with it honestly and truthfully. And there is also a letter if you don't know. So kudos to the toolkit for providing these kinds of very powerful letters. I would suggest that, as Scott mentioned, discussing the funeral arrangements with the family to find out if they even want school personnel or students to attend. Many times they do, and we like to work with them about the timing of the funeral. But I always suggest that the school send a neutral counselor, one that is not necessarily grieving, but one that could be there to provide some assessment and triage information to notice kids that may be attending that were outside our primary screening, but also to be a safe haven for many kids who may be attending their first funeral and be very anxious about approaching the casket during the funeral. The next slide, identifying students, and I think Scott covered this in terms of which kids, being at the height of their imitative behavior, may now be at risk. And the hardest kid to find there is the one for whom this loss maybe doesn't have the significance, but who has a trauma pool, if you will, who has losses in their background, and present crises always bring up past crises for kids. There are excellent suggestions in the toolkit for staff in helping kids cope. And here in LAUSD, we use a psychological first aid model called Listen, Protect, and Connect model. The basic components of psychological first aid are allowing students to ventilate their feelings and explore their feelings, and to validate those feelings, validate the wide range of reactions. Many kids just want to know that they are not going crazy. In conducting a staff planning session, we want to address staff reactions. Very important, we found in researching the text that how staff responds in the eyes of the kids is very important and will have a great impact, especially at elementary school age. So you want to pick members for your crisis team that can be cool and calm and project to the students. Our number one concern is your safety and security. Basically, we found that information is very powerful. Information helps, and people are empowered by the psychoeducational kinds of information that they receive, so you can't underestimate the power of handouts for parents, for students, and for staff as well. My students at Loyola Marymount University recognize this as HW3. How do you say what to whom when? And I wanted to highlight also some of the things that have already been said about memorials. I like the toolkit, which strives, you know, to treat all student deaths the same way. Here in LAUSD, we make the next 4 points of recommendations for memorializing students. So often in the aftermath, because now we have talked about it for so many years, the fear of contagion actually prevents schools, and they sometimes misinterpret, you know, how important memorialization is, and they get just the opposite message. We should not memorialize a student that dies by suicide because we don't want to cause others. But in reality, it is such a complex grief that all students that die need to be memorialized in some way. So reaching out to the family of the victim. And this is why we also have student councils on our crisis teams, because students can be so benevolent and have such original ideas and how to reach out to the family. Contribute to a suicide prevention effort, or Scott has also talked about the developing of living memorials. What I like in the toolkit, not only do they provide some guidelines, but there is a section on creative memorials. So I strongly urge you to check out some of the creative ways and appropriate ways that schools have memorialized those that have died by suicide in their community. And at a time when administrators might have a difficult time finding the right prevention messages to take to their staff, to students and parents, enumerated some, and the media, we've enumerated over the next couple of slides a couple of those messages, and I just want to emphasize two on these pages. There's got to be a strong message to students that suicide is not an option, that help is available. There are treatments for all the risk factors related to suicide risk in students, And as Scott said, they have to get a firm message that if you're concerned about a friend, you should never hold such information confidential. And many times we help kids right there in classrooms. Let's identify some of the adults here at school, some of the adults at home, that you can tell if you're concerned about a friend. And I feel perhaps the most important message to survivors, all of whom struggle in the immediate aftermath. My crisis team at my middle school was overwhelmed with grief themselves, all the students replaying their last interactions and feeling there was something they could have done. But the message needs to be very clear that a death by suicide is very complex and no one person, no one thing is ever to blame. And some additional prevention messages have already been addressed by my colleagues. Just thought I would end with a resource for everyone, and that is, I hit that key twice. Here we go. In order to provide guidance to the over 80 school districts of LA County Schools, a partnership was created by our County Department of Mental Health, and I'd like to give a shout out to all my psychiatric mobile responders that are listening today that work in collaboration with our schools. They are critical parts of our crisis response, helping us to identify and assess kids and finding beds for those that that need to be protected over the next couple of days. DMH, as well as the Center for Distance and Online Learning and Los Angeles School District, came together to create this website. We encourage you to visit the website, and as you can see, there's a survey monkey, and let us know how we can make it better. But I want everyone out in our audience to know it is a click, click, click world. So a lot of the materials have already been generated. You don't have to worry about reinventing the wheel. And I think that pretty much concludes my comments, so I'm going to turn it back to SPRC, and thank you very much for the opportunity today.
Rich, thank you so much. You really just provided a rich amount of information, drawing on both what Joanne had to say and also Scott's presentation as well. So we really appreciate hearing a little bit more from you about what some of these practices can really look like on the ground and how you go about implementing them in sort of more like a real-time scenario. So we have been getting a number of questions at this point, but in the interest of time, I'm going to move us ahead to introduce our two discussants. I don't think any of the questions that we got at this point were clarifying questions specific to your presentation, so we can just save those until the end. I would like to let everyone know, just as a reminder, this webinar will be archived, and the slides will be available on SPRC's Training Institute website, and we can make sure to get that web address out to people in the chat box. But also the audio portion is being recorded, too, so that I know that some people said that they had trouble joining either the online portion or the audio portion. You'll be able to access both aspects of the content for the webinar afterwards. So at this point, I would like to thank you again, Rich, and to introduce our two discussants at this point, Dale Chell and Kathy Beck Cross. Dale is the Youth Suicide Prevention Coordinator for the Iowa Department of Public Health. He managed the SAMHSA Youth Suicide Prevention Through Mental Health Screening Grant. It was a Garrett Lee Smith grant awarded to the state of Iowa in 2007. Mr. Chell also worked with other federal grant programs related to youth violence prevention and child and domestic abuse prevention, has a number of years working in those violence prevention areas. He is going to talk to us today, along with Kathy Beck Cross, about a postvention response that they worked on collaboratively together last year. And Kathy Beck Cross is a licensed social worker with 29 years of experience in a variety of settings, including schools, substance abuse treatment, adult mental health, and child protective. She is presently as the director of Central Place Family Resource and Community Education Center, a program of the Southeast Polk Community School District in Pleasant Hill, Iowa. She's co-chair of the Polk County Suicide Prevention Coalition Schools Work Group and co-developer and administrator of the Community Campaign to Build Resilient Kids. Ms. Beck-Cross helps lead the school district in postvention response activities and has provided support to multiple school districts across the state as they respond to suicide and develop prevention efforts. At this point, Tiffany is going to unmute your phone line, and we're going to hear from Dale and Kathy about how they responded to a school that experienced a group of suicides and what their collaborative experience can really bring to the conversation as they describe their actual encounters on the ground. So, Dale and Kathy, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Gail. Thanks to Scott and Joanne and Richard for their presentations and everyone joining us. Kathy and I will just briefly talk about the experience that we shared together with some suicide deaths at a Southeast Polk Community School District, and then maybe give some ideas and some pointers for others before we move to questions for the webinar. Southeast Polk is a school district with about 1,700 students, high school students, and they experienced 4 suicide deaths in a 7-month period. And, of course, this is very traumatizing, as all school communities know, even with 1 death of a youth. But with 4 in that brief time, there was certainly a call to action among the community members, the school members, as well as the community. So my role really was, as a state representative, was really to assist the school district in how we could help them move forward. And so this was rather new, of course, to the school district and to me as well, in terms of how we tried to gather support not only from school leaders but also different community leaders, mental health providers, parents, and many people will come forward to assist. I think since we've heard different presentations, and certainly utilizing the toolkit is a very important part of this, and also some of the advice given by the other presenters, is that immediate response is very critical. To have something in place ahead of time is even better. And so if you're school districts, I would strongly recommend that you get a team together to put together your policies and procedures internally, but also call upon those maybe regional or statewide leaders who can come and help you if need be in the future, because they can play an important role. I think with one of the things I've noticed that seems to be really central to a school district is that leadership stepping up very early on and getting their team together for specific tasks is really important, because you need to be able to delegate important tasks not only between school assisting students and parents, but also having that liaison person for the community in terms of handling media calls and dealing with the community meeting and other events.
Well, and I'd like to reiterate something that Dr. Poland said earlier about the community going after the school district and suggesting what has the school district done wrong to contribute to a student death. With 4 deaths in a 7-month period, we heard a lot of that. We did have people say, what's wrong with this community? What's wrong with the school district? What is the school doing? And our school district said, we're not willing to take ownership for these student deaths, but we will take responsibility for leadership and response. And since then, we've had quite a lot of community engagement activities through a group that's called the Community Campaign to Build Resilient Kids. What's nice about that is it's helped increase the capacity of the community to respond to student needs and student resiliency, and does not leave the complete burden of that upon the school district. However, when the school district is responding, one of the things I also want to reiterate is that AFSP's toolkit has excellent information. We have unfortunately had many chances to practice our crisis response plan over the last few years, and in fact earlier this week had to conduct a crisis response for 2 young men who were killed in a car crash. And I believe one of the speakers earlier indicated that this toolkit is useful for any student death, and it is. It's very helpful to have the crisis response activities delineated in advance so that when the adults who must carry out these response activities are also hurting, it's a lot easier to be able to be responsive to the students. In this most recent response that we had, we actually began to see a change in how youth respond to the postvention activities that are offered, and this was a change for the better for us. We began to see youth taking more care of each other, more willing to open up about their own feelings in response to the loss of their classmates. And it really seemed more like a learning activity for all of the folks involved. Now, you don't want to have a death in your midst to be a learning activity, but the fact of life is that it is. We all learn and change and grow based on the activities that are, and the events that happen in our lives, and it was really very helpful to have to be able to see the students respond in a way that made it clear they were taking care of each other's mental health as well. And then, as mentioned in the toolkit, we just yesterday met to review our crisis plan, talked about what worked well, what didn't work so well, how to make changes. And if I had just one thing to say about the crisis plan, I think it's so important that organizations, whether they're school districts or agencies or whoever's developing a crisis plan, review it regularly. The last thing you want when you need to implement it is to find out the phone numbers aren't correct and the people don't work there anymore, and you've moved to another building, and so the structural aspect of what you're dealing with is completely different. The other thing I'd like to indicate is reinforcement for the school-based mental health screenings. We implemented Teen Screen starting in 2006, and we actually started, we talked about the idea of implementing the Teen Screen before we had any student suicides. And we did have one in February of 2006 that was the first student suicide in over 20 years. We had already initiated the process of starting the Teen Screen, and so to the outside it looked like we were having a knee-jerk reaction, but those of you who do carry out Teen Screen or other mental health screenings in your school district know that that's not something that happens overnight. However, I will tell you that the losing several students certainly cemented the importance of Teen Screen, and we've continued to implement that over the years.
Before we move to questions, I just had a couple comments for those of you who are either statewide or regional leaders who aren't really working in the school. Is listening in, I think this is an opportunity to reach out and provide lots of training opportunities for school districts. Some ideas would be providing workshops on postvention, actually setting up formalized training for postvention and offering it to school districts either individually or a statewide conference, or especially workshops of conferences that they hold. That gets them involved, and you might even want to start with something very specific like, you know, updating your crisis plan or developing your team, so that you have schools thinking about this ahead of time so they can bring back that information.
And then I'd like to just close with a very brief story that relates to something one of the other speakers said about how you don't always know what kind of traumatic response a student is going to have. And just because a student did not necessarily know the young person who died does not mean that the classmate will not feel trauma from that. In 2006, when we had that suicide that I referred to that had been our first in two decades, we had a young girl who was really, really struggling with the suicide, and her peers were being critical of her and suggesting that she didn't have any reason to grieve because she didn't really know the person who died. And what this girl said was, well, she was in my science class, and in my science class, nobody else talked to me except her. And now nobody will talk to me in that class. And so I think we have to realize that there's vicarious trauma, even for kids who did not necessarily know the student directly, and remember that when we're conducting our postvention response.
So, Gail, I know we could certainly talk more, but maybe do you want to leave some time at the end for questions to the other presenters?
We can definitely do that. Thank you so much, Dale, and thank you, Kathy, for talking a little bit about the way that you worked collaboratively to respond to the situation in the Southeast School last year, Southeast Polk School last year, rather. I know it's always really helpful to have an example like that to just illustrate, you know, some of the points that our other speakers had been talking about, and really sort of discuss how things can unfold on the ground, especially if you're in a situation where you might be experiencing, you know, more than one suicide death, and how that can change your response a bit. So at this point, we are going to unmute Rich's line and also Joanne's line. I think, unfortunately, at this point, we seem to have lost Scott Poland, so he will not be joining us for the discussion portion, but I will be able to pose some questions to you as a group. And what we can start with at this point, first I want to recognize that I know a number of people have written in with questions about specific situations in their schools, and unfortunately, I think while we really appreciate hearing from you, we won't be able to get to all of these questions. And so I would really encourage you to be in touch with us at SPRC, certainly, as a follow-up. And, you know, you're also welcome to contact the presenters as well if your question is more specific to what they covered. So there have been a number of questions that have come in along the lines of what to do if you are either in a school and you're trying to navigate some of the information and some of the facts that are coming in, and you want to do the right thing. You know that a suicide death has occurred. You've gotten the facts, but you're running into a situation where the parents of the student who died are really reluctant to have you share any information publicly about that with the students and with other personnel at the school. And conversely, when there are parents who have, you know, information that they want to make readily available, and the school's really, you know, hesitant to do that and concerned about the safety of sharing that information. So if you could speak to maybe Joanne and Rich, if you want to sort of get us started talking about that question. And Dale and Kathy, this may or may not have been something that was an issue when you were responding to Southeast Polk, but please feel free to jump in as well.
Well, I would like to emphasize, you know, that the toolkit really anticipated this kind of enigma, and you know, and provided letters when parents, you know, don't wish any of the facts to be discussed at the school. Of course, you know, there are some very difficult decisions that have to be made. A school administrator's responsibility is the safety and security of all of their surviving students. So sometimes they have to make difficult decisions on releasing certain kinds of information. We always want to work collaboratively with the family and adhere to their wishes. We take strong messages to our students that, please, out of respect, you know, we encourage our students to get involved in rumor control, that if you're seeing kids talking on these on the schoolyard or in chat rooms, you need to step up and say, please respect the family's wishes for privacy at this most difficult time. And redirect kids to, you know, what prevention messages you want to get out there, what kinds of roles they can play in identifying kids that we need to follow up with.
And I would just add that if you're in a situation where the family is reluctant to share the information, one way for the school to handle it in their communications, both with the students and with the parents, is to say, we're aware that there are a lot of rumors going around that this was a suicide, and what we want to do is use this as a teachable moment to talk about the issue of suicide generally, to talk about resources that are available for kids who may be struggling with depression or anxiety or substance abuse, to make the community aware of what's out there by way of information and opportunities for help, so that the school isn't necessarily commenting specifically on whether this particular child did or did not die by suicide, but rather is acknowledging that everyone is talking about it, and to make sure that that conversation includes reliable information.
And I'd also add that the recommendation the toolkit makes in terms of conducting a community forum, we found these to be very powerful, that on almost all occasions, you know, you have tremendous parent impact in the aftermath of a suicide and how the school is proceeding. So we like to immediately schedule, we informally refer to it as a y'all come. So we get the y'all come, and we invite parents. I like Joanne's suggestions in terms of, you know, this is a psychoeducational kind of presentation and not a forum for what, you know, a very common reaction, which is anger for parents to come in and be upset with the school district. I think that when we provide information, you diffuse a lot of the anger. And perhaps they learn that their anger is a very normal, natural kind of response to what happened, and that very often the school or individuals are a place their anger is going to, not a place their anger is coming from. And many times that'll diffuse anger.
Dale and Kathy, did you have anything that you wanted to add along these lines from your experience?
I can tell you that in 2008, when we had the 4 deaths in a 7-month period, the parents did not want us to acknowledge publicly that it was suicide in any of those deaths, and we respectfully honored their wishes. However, in 2009, we had a student who died by suicide, and his parents did allow us to acknowledge that it was a suicide. And that was actually very helpful, because it's the elephant in the living room that the kids all know about, we just can't talk about. And I think that all goes back to the stigma issue, and that I think people realize certainly that when somebody dies by suicide, there's very likely to have been depression or some other mental health concern, and nobody really wants to talk about those mental health concerns. If they died by a heart attack, we'd be glad to talk about it, but we don't want to talk about emotional difficulties.
Okay, thank you all for responding to that question. We are just about out of time at this point, but I want to say that, you know, a number of the questions that were coming in were some of the questions that I think, you know, both SPRC and AFSB had been either fielding or hearing about from our collaborative partners in the school, and those are the questions that really led us to, you know, to need to further assess what the field itself was really asking for and, you know, sort of needing very much, and what kind of a resource we could create to address a number of those questions and situations that were coming up, and be able to address them in a way that felt accessible and readily available and very practical for use in the moment or, you know, in preparation for whenever a tragic suicide death situation might occur. And, you know, at this point, I would encourage people, if you find that your questions were not answered on today's webinar, they may very well be answered by some of the content in the toolkit. I know some people wrote in about roles for specific personnel in the school or, you know, what information guidance might be available for clergy members. There's some in the toolkit itself. I would also strongly encourage you to take a look at SPRC's online library. You can access that through our homepage. There are different categories for populations and setting. There are a good amount of materials in there that I think will answer some of the questions that people were writing in about today. If you find that your question has not been answered and you'd like to connect with us you know, by email, please feel free to give us a message at info@sprc.org. So at this point, I would again like to thank all three of our speakers, Dr. Scott Poland, Joanne Harpel, Rich Lieberman, as well as our two discussants, Dale Chell and Kathy Beck-Cross, and to you for participating in this webinar and for your interest in this topic. Clearly, it's something that is immediately relevant for a lot of people in the field. I know that we had a number of schools from across the country joining, as well as partners who work with them at the state level, with other organizations, interested members of the community, and others. And we really just appreciate your interest today, your time today, and we look forward to continuing the conversation. Take care, everyone.